Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the show, Brian Lynn brings us the technology report. We also hear about winemaking in Sweden from Dan Friedel and Faith Perlow. We close the show with another part in our 2015 travel series, Route 66. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr. with a report about Hurricane Idalia.
Hurricane Idalia made landfall on the west coast of the American state of Florida on Wednesday. Officials said the dangerous storm brought life-threatening storm surges and flooding to the area. By early Wednesday morning, more than 200,000 people reportedly were without electricity as strong winds brought down trees and power lines. Along the coast, some homes were underwater and structures were crushed in the storm surge. "We have multiple trees down, debris in the roads. Do not come," emergency officials in Cedar Key said. They said most of the streets around the downtown area were underwater. Idalia landed in a lightly populated area near Keaton Beach at 11:45 UTC. The Category 3 hurricane came with sustained wind speeds as high as 205 kilometers per hour. The National Weather Service places hurricanes into five groups depending on wind speed. The strongest level, a Category 5 hurricane, can reach sustained wind speeds of 252 kilometers an hour or higher. People who live along Florida's northwest coast had been ordered to leave the area before Idalia's arrival. On Wednesday morning, Governor Ron DeSantis told those who had not left to stay inside until the storm passed. He said, "Don't put your life at risk." As the hurricane continues, a rare full moon, called a supermoon, could cause tides to rise higher than normal along Florida's coast. When the moon is full, the sun and the moon are pulling in the same direction. This has the effect of increasing tides above normal, said Kerry Emanuel. He is an atmospheric scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. "The moon's gravitational pull is stronger when it is closer to the Earth, so the tides could be higher. Wednesday's supermoon is the closest to the Earth this year." Brian Haynes is head of the National Weather Service office in Charleston, South Carolina. He said, "I would say the timing is pretty bad for this one." The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recently said the 2023 hurricane season would be far more active because of extremely warm ocean temperatures. The season runs through November, with most storms taking place in August and September. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Most people would not connect the country of Sweden with the tradition of fine winemaking. It is far north of the famous wine-growing areas in France, Italy, or Spain, where the tradition is ancient. However, climate change is making for warmer and longer growing seasons in Sweden. There are also new kinds of grapes created especially for the country's environment. As a result, winemaking is a growing industry. Its growth comes as drought, rising heat, and other extreme weather are forcing traditional winemaking areas to rethink their growing methods. The Swedish Meteorological and Hydrological Institute reports temperatures in the country's south have increased by about 2 degrees Celsius over the past 30 years, compared to the 30 years earlier. The experts also say Sweden's growing season has lengthened by about 20 days. Felix Orberg is the chief oenologist, or expert winemaker, at the 14-hectare Kullebergs Vingård near the North Sea. He noted that the rising temperatures are hurting vineyards in traditional winemaking countries. At the same time, we are gaining momentum, he said. Kullebergs produces about 30,000 bottles of wine yearly. Some of their wines have won prizes in different competitions. Costly restaurants from Hong Kong to Europe sell the wine.
Even some oenologists from France are settling in Sweden to grow grapes and careers. It is the new frontier of winemaking, and grapes grow best on their coolest frontier, Orberg said. Emberto is one such winemaker from France, who now works at Tua Vingård, about 20 kilometers from Orberg's land. She and her partner, Roman Shishari, moved to Sweden for the chance to lead a vineyard just after completing their education. They say Sweden's climate is more predictable than France's. There, the early spring weather can be too warm, and the grapes begin to develop before they should. In addition, Berto and Shishari said they want to use more sustainable grape-growing methods, including limits on insect poisoning. Shishari said France has been making wine for so long. There are many rules winemakers must follow. In Sweden, it is a newer business, so there is more freedom. However, there is still a lot to learn about growing grapes in Sweden. The main grape grown in the country is Solaris, which began in Germany and grows well in Northern Europe. The winemakers treat the vines differently, too. In Sweden, the leaves are removed from the vines, so the grapes can receive more sunlight. In France and Spain, sometimes winemakers are worried the grapes will get too much. The Tua owners who hired the French winemakers are Johan and Heather Oberg. They depend on wine experts from traditional winemaking countries because Swedish universities do not have study programs in the science and practice of winemaking. Martin van Alst is a climate professor at the University of Twente in the Netherlands. He said businesses are often first to identify and react to climate change. He said it is good that climate change is partly something we can adapt to. But, he warned, it is not all good weather in Sweden. He pointed to recent heavy rains that caused flooding, resulting in $150 million in damage. He said bad weather is becoming more common because of human-caused climate change.
In Sweden, vineyards account for about 150 hectares of land. The number is 1 million in Spain and about 800,000 in France. Swedish winemakers hope that as the industry grows, the government will make rules that help them expand their businesses. For example, right now in Sweden, winemakers cannot sell their own wine. People who want a bottle must purchase from a government-run store. Mikael Mustad writes about wine. He said, "The Swedish government is not in favor of making it easier to buy alcohol." Politicians, he said, still see alcohol as a social problem. Goran Umnigård is a prize-winning winemaker who started 20 years ago. He is pleased to see more wineries opening in Sweden. He thinks more people will come to take advantage of the warmer temperatures and longer growing time. "I can see things growing here that were unthinkable 30 or 40 years ago," Umnigård said as he looked out over his small vineyard. "We're seeing fruit trees like peaches and apricots. I'm getting beautiful peaches in August." I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Faith Perlow.
Google has launched a tool designed to mark identity on images created by artificial intelligence, AI, technology. The American-based search engine and online advertising company announced the new tool in a statement Tuesday. Google has already made the system available to a limited number of beta testers. Google plans to expand its use in the future. A team at Google DeepMind developed the tool called SynthID in partnership with Google Research. SynthID is designed to work with Google's AI image creator, Imagen. That system creates full film-quality images from simple text commands. For now, only Imagen users will be able to use the AI identifying tool. SynthID works by creating a hidden digital watermark on images. Watermarks have long been used with paper documents and money as a way to mark them as being real or authentic. With this method, paper can be held up to a light to see if a watermark exists and the document is authentic. A digital watermark serves the same purpose, but it uses technology to digitally embed hidden markers in images. These watermarks are hard to see by just looking at an image. Instead, special tools are needed to identify the watermark. Google says the digital watermark is designed to help individuals and companies identify whether an image has been created by AI tools or not. This could help people recognize inauthentic pictures published online and also protect copyright-protected images. Technology experts have identified these issues as two of the biggest problems with AI creation tools. They can increase the amount of misinformation online, and they can violate copyrights. Last month, Google's parent Alphabet joined other major technology companies in agreeing to establish watermark tools to help make AI technology safer. The companies, including Facebook parent Meta, Microsoft-backed AI developer OpenAI, and online seller Amazon, made the agreement during a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House. They promised to fully develop and test watermarking tools for content, including text, audio, and video. Google said its system embeds a digital watermark directly into the details of an image. The tool can be used for connecting people with high-quality information and upholding trust between creators and users across society. Developers of the SynthID system said it is built to keep the watermark in place even if the image itself is changed by creative tools designed to resize pictures or add additional light or color. The tool can add a hidden watermark to AI-produced images created by Imogen. SynthID can also examine an image to find a digital watermark that was embedded with the Imogen system. Google says it will continue to test the watermarking tool and hopes to collect many user experiences from the current beta testers. And the company looks forward to adding the system to other Google products and making it available to more individuals and organizations. In addition to SynthID, Google also announced Tuesday the launch of additional AI tools designed for businesses and structural improvements to its computing systems. Those systems are used to produce AI tools, also known as large language models. Google made public a new version of its self-designed AI computing chips. The company says the new chip, called TPU V5E, was built to train large computer models, but also more effectively serve those models. Google also released new versions of software and security tools designed to work with AI systems. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about his technology report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
You're welcome, Katie. Glad to be here.
In this week's report, we learned about a tool Google designed to identify whether an image was created by artificial intelligence technology. I know the need for this kind of digital watermark has been discussed before. Is this the first tool of its kind to be released?
Yes, so far it is. And I should note, as pointed out in the report, that the launch of the tool, called SynthID, is at this point very limited. It is still being tested by a group of users who currently use Google's AI image creator called Imogen. But even though the system has not yet been widely released, it is the first watermark tool designed for AI content to be publicly announced.
This particular tool is meant to be used with images. Did Google say it plans to build additional tools for other kinds of content, like text, audio, and video?
So, first of all, the company did say the SynthID tool needs further development and testing before being widely released, and it hopes to get a lot of feedback from the beta testers currently experimenting with it. So it is likely to complete that work first, but Google has said it plans to create similar watermark technology to be used with other forms of content.
Brian, do you think the release of Google's tool will speed up development efforts of watermarking tools by other companies?
I would say this is highly likely, and some industry experts have even suggested additional watermarking tools could be released as soon as in the coming weeks, And the report notes that representatives from other major technology companies promised during a meeting last month at the White House that they would develop and test these kinds of tools for their AI systems.
Well, thank you very much for chatting, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Katie.
In September of 2015, VOA Learning English traveled along the famous Route 66, the 3,900-kilometer-long highway stretches from Chicago, Illinois, to Los Angeles, California. For the next 2 weeks, you will hear our reports from the road. We tell you about the communities, the people, the food, and the special landmarks that make up the highway that's the best. These stories first aired in late 2015.
When American officials established U.S. Route 66 in 1926, the road cut right through the southwestern city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. For 11 years, Route 66 travelers passed through Santa Fe, known as the City Different, with its mix of Native American, Spanish, and Anglo cultures. But in 1937, the road was redirected following a political dispute. Santa Fe holds on to its Route 66 history, however. Historic motels and old street signs still mark the original path of the Mother Road. And it remains possible to take that original path up to Santa Fe. Many of today's Route 66 travelers do just that.
Santa Fe is the oldest capital city in the United States. It was the capital of the Spanish Kingdom of New Mexico beginning in 1610. It was the capital of the province of Nuevo Mexico when Mexico became independent. And it was the capital of the New Mexico Territory before it became a U.S. state. Frank McGuire is an artist from Tempe, Arizona. He has been visiting Santa Fe for decades.
Originally, this was settled by the Native Americans, so the Pueblo Indians that were here. And the Spanish came, and this is actually the oldest capital in the United States. This was settled long before the East Coast was.
The city is home to the country's oldest church and the oldest house. Visitors can tour both. In the house, visitors get a feel for how Pueblo Indians in the area lived hundreds of years ago.
The Pueblo Indians built their villages with adobe brick. Adobe is a mix of mud and straw. It becomes very hard when it dries. Traditional adobe buildings do not use frames. Most are 1 to 2 stories high. In the 1920s, Santa Fe officials ordered that all buildings in the city be built with adobe in the Pueblo Indian style. The city also retains beautiful examples of Victorian, Italian, and Spanish architecture. It is this combination of cultures that helped give Santa Fe its most popular nickname, the City Different. Artist Frank McGuire explains.
So you have the mixture of the Native Americans, the Spaniards, the Mexicans, and then, of course, the Anglos came. So to me, it has a broad culture, and that would why I would say it has a City of Difference, because there are so many different cultures blended together here.
Santa Fe's food represents that blend of cultures. Traditional New Mexican cuisine is a mix of Native American and Hispanic influences. One of the defining tastes is the New Mexico chili. Bunches of chilies often hang to dry outside of the adobe-style homes in Santa Fe. New Mexican chilies are red or green, depending on when they are harvested. Chili sauce is served on top of many of the common dishes here, and people quickly get used to hearing the question, red, green, or Christmas? Diners choose between red chili sauce, green chili sauce, or both, the colors of Christmas.
Santa Fe's Plaza has been the heart of the city for some 400 years. On most days, artists fill the plaza with small tents offering pieces of art for sale, paintings, jewelry, rugs, and much more. Artists come to Santa Fe from all over the world. But there are many locals, too. Santa Fe became a so-called artist colony in the 1920s. The city offered low-cost living and beautiful scenery. The landscape inspired artists. Today, the city of 150,000 people is home to hundreds of art galleries and many world-class art museums. One is dedicated to American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. She settled in Santa Fe in 1949 and lived there until her death in 1986. She became famous for her large paintings of brightly colored flowers. Much of her art reflects the nature and culture of New Mexico.
Roberto Marquez is an artist from Tucson, Arizona. He sells his handmade metal fountains in the plaza. He looks forward to his Santa Fe visits for the weather and atmosphere.
I love Santa Fe. I love this weather. I love the people. And to me, it's like vacation, so I combine vacation and work and can't ask for anything better.
Bernadine Toya is from San Felipe Pueblo, an Indian reservation near Santa Fe. She often visits Santa Fe with her husband. He sells his art and bows and arrows at the Native American Vendors Program of Santa Fe's Palace of the Governors. The building sits right along the plaza.
We just walk around and see what's new, and there's always something new. It's very diverse nowadays, and it's just very different from reservation life, and it's very upbeat, nice energy.
Frank McGuire is a fan too.
Santa Fe has a kind of a rich history of art. I mean, the Native Americans created beautiful art out of very simple tools and pigments, you know, thousands of years ago. And then, of course, the Spanish brought their art, which some of it was from Spain and Italy, and so because there was a mixture. And then the Anglos brought theirs. But the city has kind of a unique blend of cultures. You can kind of find it just roaming the streets here.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Join us next week for a report on Arizona's Route 66. That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.